So, I said last week we started off this with Job chapter 1, looking at this big issue of suffering and the question of why me? Job, I said last week, is actually a poem in Hebrew. It's a long, long, epic poem. And it's one of the longest pieces of ancient literature that we have, probably the longest, about one person in regards to one subject, and this subject being suffering. And so it's been used as the archetype, it's been used as the model for understanding what to do with suffering when it comes on you. What's the answer to it? And now here, let me say this, let me give a couple disclaimers. Last week I said this, I know it's hard to come into, not everybody can make it to church each week, and I understand that, but I encouraged everybody to then try to go online and get the rest of the sermons and the other messages so you can piece this together, because far too often in churches, pastors, preachers have taken one verse here and there of Job and said, this is the answer for suffering. And if you do that, first of all, it's 40 plus chapters. You'd be making an egregious mistake. You can't piecemeal the book of Job. You can't just take one thing and say, well, this is what he says about suffering, because it's a long book. It's a long poem. And there's nuances and there's complexities. And actually, all the time, Job's three friends, if you've been in church for any number of years, get a horrible rap, don't they? These guys, Eliphaz and Bildad and Zerah, they get these horrible raps about, oh, they're the ones who have the wrong understanding of suffering. But you'll see today, they actually get something right about how to comfort somebody who's going through suffering. So I encourage you then to look at this whole book. Stay with us for the whole time if you can. It's not that long. It's only going to be about 5-6 weeks. And if you miss anything, go back and get it online, because it's a sensitive subject. And I don't take this lightly. I don't at all, because people go through pain. And people have the big question, and probably the number one question I've ever been asked as a church-going guy, why suffering? Why? Why do those people die and those people live? And if you look back, just to recap really quickly in about 20 seconds, last week's message, there's no easy answer to it. Job was upright. He was blameless. And yet he gets ransacked. Why? His friends come and they offer him an answer. His wife offers him an answer. And at the end of the book, God looks at him and doesn't give him an answer. And that is incredibly frustrating for us, is it not? I know, you can admit it. That leaves you with the ultimate cliffhanger. That at the end of this book, God does not give Job an answer. He doesn't. He doesn't say, Job, by the way, a couple like weeks ago, Satan came to me, we talked about things, and I figured this would be a good test for you, blah, blah, blah. He doesn't give him an answer. And it's incredibly infuriating to folks like you and me. And this is why. Because our modern post-enlightenment minds think that we have the right to empirically understand everything. See, we live in 2017, let's be honest. Our culture and our mindset tells us we should be able to know why God gives us pain and suffering. And that's a fair question to ask. You can ask that question. That's totally fair. But listen, go back 500, 600, 700,000 years. They weren't asking that question. The why wasn't as important as the what now. And the book of Job gives us a what now about suffering. There's no reason why Job suffered. He was blameless. He was upright. His kids were the troublemakers, actually. And he was constantly covering for them. He was going to the temple and giving sacrifices for his little petulant kids who just partied all the time. He had no reason why he would suffer, and yet he does. Everything's taken from him except for his life. And you're bound to look at that and say, well, this is a mean, despotic, tyrannical God. But not so much. Because Job points us to somebody even greater who suffers. But he suffers for a reason. Job cries out. He doesn't get an answer. Somebody comes a lot later and cries out, and he doesn't get an answer. But he gets you. See, in our brains, I know, and let me spend a couple of seconds on this before I move on. I know it's troubling for us to say that there may be no why to the suffering. You may never know the reason why you and I go through pains and trials, and I know that's cold, and I know that's harsh for me to say from up here. But here, play that out logically. You might say to yourself, listen, I'm intellectually trained enough. I'm smart enough. God should be able to tell me why I suffer. But play that out logically. There's a lot of other people in the world who are smarter than you. Should they know more about suffering than you? No. Well, you say, well, I have higher EQ. I'm more emotionally compatible and compassionate. So therefore, God has a right. He deserves to tell me why I'm suffering. Wait a second. There's a lot more people out in the world who are compassionate than you are. Do they deserve to know more about suffering than you? No. The book of Job tells us it's not a stratosphere of understanding. Rather, it's coming back into a relationship. And at the end of the book of Job, God says, that's what I wanted from you, Job. Love me for me, not for what I give you. If you never know an answer, will you still love me? And we know too, I said last week, suffering's inevitable. The Christian life doesn't promise that suffering's not going to happen. That's fool's gold. You become a Christian and life is roses and rainbows. No. And most of you have been Christians for a long time know this. Becoming a Christian doesn't preclude you from suffering. Actually, sometimes it includes you into suffering. The suffering of others. You see the pain in the world and you want to enter into it. You see your own pain and your own brokenness, your own heartache. Suffering's inevitable. It happens. There's this great line from Macbeth, and it's actually the only line I ever remember from Macbeth, where Macduff's family and Malcolm, Macduff and Malcolm are friends, you remember? And Macduff's family gets murdered and he hears about it. Macbeth is on the rage. He's like hot crazy right at this point, and he's going after everybody. And Macduff and his friend Malcolm, they get together and they say, let's go to some shady place to plot revenge. They say, let's go get shade. It's a pun. Let's go to a shady place, get shade, get it. They say, let's go to a shady place and get revenge. And he says this, Macduff says, bestride our downfall birthdom, each new morn, new widows howl, new orphans cry, new sorrows strike heavens on the face that it resounds. He gets it. Each new morn, new widows will howl, new orphans cry, new sorrows. There's a point to say, so we get revenge, suffering will come again. What's the point, he says. He gets that suffering's not only inevitable, but it's not answerable by revenge or hate or anger. Each new morn, new widows howl. It's coming. So what do you do about it? How do you handle it? And more importantly, like I said, tonight, let's do this. Take the spotlight off yourself and think about somebody in your life now or in the past who's gone through sufferings, who's been the Job, who's been the one that on the ground everybody walks by and spits on, who's lost everything. Maybe they've lost loved ones. Maybe they lost money. Maybe they lost career. Maybe lost whatever. Think about them tonight, because that's what this passage teaches us. Comfort. Comfort. Job has three friends, and they show up. And they got a lot to say, by the way. Chapters 3 through 20, they just go back and forth. They can't stop giving him advice. They say, Job, this is your problem. Another friend says, no, Job, this is your problem. Another one says, Job, this is your problem. Even Job's wife chimes in and she says, his wife said to him, do you not still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. She's like, get over it. Move on. Everybody's got a piece of advice for Job. Everybody's got words of comfort. And there's comes a point in chapter 16 where Job calls them miserable comforters because nothing that they say to him helps him one bit. But there's something that they do that does help him. So if you're following along here, write your outline like this. First, I want to look at this under these three headings. There's miserable comfort that you can give to somebody when they're suffering. And that's what his friends do in large part. There's miserable comfort. There's friendly comfort. And his friends do that a little bit too. They're not all right. They're not all wrong. There's a complexity and a nuance to it. There's miserable comfort. There's friendly comfort. But ultimately, there's gospel comfort. And that's what saves Job. And Eliphaz, even though he doesn't realize it, says it to him. I'll get to that in a little bit. First, miserable comfort. This is awesome. I love Eliphaz. See, we believe that Eliphaz was the oldest of his friends, so he speaks first, and he speaks the longest. Isn't that what like old people do? Well, let me tell you something. I know what you're going through. Let me tell you something. Old people always think they know what they're talking about, right? Eliphaz was the older one, so he talks the most, and he talks first. And his advice is this. Look back at chapter 4, verse 7. He says, remember, and he's being a little sarcastic with him, by the way. He says, remember who that was in it ever perished? Who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity sow trouble and reap the same. You know what he's saying? You did this, Job. He's saying, look, I've lived my whole life. I'm old. I've never seen somebody who's lived a good life and suffered. Ergo, ipso facto, Job, you must have done this. He's like needling him. Do you get this? What a good friend he is, right? This is miserable comfort. By the way, that's good theology. It's good theology. He knows his Bible, Eliphaz does. He's getting it from the Bible. He's getting good theology, sound doctrine. And he says, who has never had iniquity, has ever been cut off? Great. Does that help Job? No. That's churchy advice. That's miserable comfort. See, what Eliphaz is doing is he's over-spiritualizing Job's problems. It's a miserable comfort. Hold on, I know. A pastor says don't spiritualize problems. Spirituality is good. And basically what he's saying to Job is, you could translate it to this, Job, you didn't pray enough. Job, you weren't good enough. Job, something you did was wrong. You didn't go to church enough. You didn't worship hard enough. You didn't believe. And therefore, this is what's happening to you. See what he's going on? He's going on the back end. He's being very poetic about it and very, very nice. But he's digging at him. He says, who's ever without iniquities ever perished? Nobody. So ergo, Job, if you're suffering, it's your problem. You did something wrong. And he's giving this great spiritual advice, and that's good. It's like a friend who came to you when you're suffering, and they spout off all the biblical passages. Nothing's wrong with the Bible. It's great. But you know that in your times of suffering, sometimes that doesn't help. Spiritual advice is wonderful. Pray more. Read more. Come to church more. That's all great advice. But it doesn't do Job any good. Because Eliphaz is over-spiritualizing the suffering. He's being a miserable comforter. Let me put it this way. Spiritual advice is great, but you and I are physical beings. Sometimes isn't it just good to get a hug? Sometimes isn't it just good to have somebody say, I'll walk on the ocean with you or the beach with you. Come out to the sunshine. We're physical beings. Here Eliphaz is wagging his finger and he's giving him great doctrine and great theology. But it doesn't make any difference for him. And I believe, this is what I believe, this is Eric speaking, not the Bible, that we're physical beings, and I'll back it up with the Bible in a second. Sometimes you just want a hug. Sometimes you just want a hand hold and someone to cry with. Sometimes you just want a warm meal, not spiritual advice. Here, let me show you what I mean. If you have your Bibles open or you want to write this down as a reference, 1 Kings chapter 19. We're physical beings, and sometimes that's the greatest help in the greatest time of need. Here, the story of Jezebel, the queen. She's coming after Elijah. Elijah just struck down all of her prophets. And she says in 1 Kings 19, verse 2, that Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, so may the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow. Then he was afraid, it says, Elijah. And he arose and he ran for his life and he came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and he left his servant there. He's afraid. He's alone. He's suffering. He leaves by the servant, the very person who's supposed to help him in time of need. He's utterly alone, but it goes even further. He says, but he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree, and he asked that he might die, saying, it is enough now, O Lord. Take away my life, for I am no better than my father's. He is at the bottom. He's suicidal. And he lay down and he slept under a broom tree. Now here, pay attention. What does God tell him? How does God lift him up from a suicidal, depressive state where he's utterly alone and he's in the wilderness? Does God say, buck up, champ? Does he say, just pray to me more? No. It says that an angel touched him and said to him, arise and eat. And he looked, and behold, there was at the head of a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. And he ate and he drank and he lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, arise and eat, for the journey is too great for you. And he rose and he ate and he drank, and he went into the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mount of God. Now listen, did the angel give him spiritual advice? Did the angel give him theology or doctrine? He said, get up, eat something hot. That's what will give you the strength to get through this. Theology, spiritual advice, doctrine, they're all good. Praying, meditating, Bible, I'm a pastor, I like it, it's good. But there are times when you and I will see others in suffering, and if you go to them and spout that out to them, you'll be just like Job's friend, it will mean nothing. Maybe you need to say, arise and eat, touch them. The angel touched him. And he said, eat, get the strength. See, the story of Eliphaz, and actually the advice of his other friends that we'll see in a couple of weeks or so, it's all really good advice. It's all really good. But it's not the comfort that Job needs. Let me give you another story. Jesus, in the book of John, chapter 11. Many of you know this story, one of my favorite. His buddy, his good friend, Lazarus, is dead. Martha comes to him, runs to him, and she says, I'm paraphrasing, if you had been there, you could raise him. He wouldn't have died. And Jesus says, what's going on? And Martha says, he says, do you not believe who I am? And Martha says, I know that on the last day he'll be resurrected. Great theology. And Jesus says, you're right. Mary runs to Jesus and she's weeping. And she says the same thing, and what does Jesus do? He goes to the tomb, and he weeps. It says that he weeps uncontrollably. He cries. Now, this is Jesus. He's got all the theology. Don't give him theology. It's Jesus, after all. Don't quote Bible passages to him. It's Jesus. If you had walked up to him in front of the empty tomb as he cried, and you say, oh, just Jesus, you'll get through it. Pray and pray and live all the day. Jesus would have probably looked at you and said, I'm Jesus. I don't need to hear that. I'm crying. I just want my good friend back. And this is Jesus, who knows in a couple of minutes he's going to raise him from the dead, and he weeps uncontrollably. Now I tell you, if Jesus can cry over somebody else's suffering, how can you and I not cry and be silent? Miserable comfort is the churchy comfort, the cliches. And they're good. Give verses to people. I'm not barring you from doing that. All I want you to know is when you walk into a situation, don't be an Eliphaz where you just wag the finger and say, well, you did this yourself. Or if you just read more, prayed more, went to church more, it all would be good. No, no, no. You need to learn the friendly comfort. And here's the friendly comfort. There you go. First Kings, you got it going. There you go. See, he wrote it down. He's going to have my reference now. That's nice. I like it. Somebody's paying attention out there. I like it. Preach it. How do you go from miserable comfort to what they do well? And I told you, these three friends, they do something well. They do it really well. I started what they did badly, and I'm going to go back to what they do well to lead you into how you and me can be better comforters. Here's what I'm talking about, friendly comfort. Go back to Job chapter 2. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all the evil that had come upon him, they came each from his own place, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. They made an appointment. They called him. They went to show him, to sympathy and comfort him. They cared. And when they saw him from a distance, they did not recognize him. He was messed up. But they didn't go the other way. They went to him. He was a hot mess. And they had every right to turn around and say, not our problem. They made an appointment. They called. They went with sympathy because they cared. They saw him and he was horribly looking, and they said, I'll go to him. And they raised their voices, and they wept, and they tore their robes, and they sprinkled dust on their heads, and this is the coolest part, verse 13, and they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that suffering was very great. This is friendly comfort. The friend who comes to you and says, it cost me nothing. I'll sit. I won't wag my finger. And I won't give you petty contrivances or Christian cliches. I won't fill your head with that. They sit with him at first. They suffer with him. They cry with him. They weep with him. They have every right to turn their back and leave. Friendly comfort says, no, I will stay. And more importantly, I'll stay. And maybe I'll shut my mouth. And I'll sit with you in the ashes. Do you imagine that? Your friend sitting by the city gates and little kids coming and spitting on them. And you go down on the ground and you sit with them. And you wait with them 7 days and seven nights. By the way, this is a poem. That's a poetic device. That's the way they said they did it. A long, 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 long time. They would have had to cancel personal appointments. They would have to make personal sacrifices to do this. Do you realize this? They didn't just sit with him one night and go, okay, you're good, Job. Got to go. Peace out. No, they sat with him. They cried with him. And they didn't say a word because that was friendship. C.S. Lewis has got this great line in The Four Loves, not a line. I'm going to put it up here so you can follow along. And he talks about friendship, this type of friendship, friendly comfort, what it means to be a friend to those who are suffering. And he says, others again would say that friendship is extremely useful, perhaps necessary to survival to the individual. They could produce plenty of authority, saying such as, bear his back without brother behind it. And there's a friend that sticketh closer than a brother. But when we speak thus, we are using friend to mean ally. In ordinary usage, friend means, or should mean, much more than that. A friend will, to be sure, prove himself to be also an ally when an alliance becomes necessary, or will lend or give when we are in need, nurse us in sickness, stand up for us among our enemies, do what he can for our widows and orphans. But such good offices are not the stuff of friendship. The occasions for them are almost interruptions. They are in one way relevant to it, in another not. Relevant because you would be a false friend if you would not do them when the need arose. Irrelevant because the role of benefactor always remains accidental. even a little alien to that of a friend. It's almost embarrassing. For friendship is utterly free from affection's need to be needed. We are sorry that any gift or loan or night watching should have been necessary, and now, for heaven's sake, let us forget all about it and go back to the things we really want to do or talk of together. Even gratitude is no enrichment to this love. The stereotyped, oh, don't mention it, here expresses what we really feel. The mark of perfect friendship is not that help will be given when the pinch comes. Of course it will. But that having been given, it makes no difference at all. What he's saying is, it's almost as if you look at a friend and you say, of course I'm going to be there for you. It's almost embarrassing to say, don't mention it. The friendship comfort says, yeah, I'll sit with you, of course. But that's just an interruption to what our friendship really means. Let's talk about it. Let's go about life together. It's not advice giving, necessarily. It's not lecture giving, necessarily. It's not good theology giving or doctrine giving, necessarily. Because in a pinch, you know the friend will be there. But having given, it makes really no difference at all, because you know they say now. It's almost irrelevant. I don't need to be needed, a friend says, like affection does. I'm your friend, and I'll sit. The mark of friendship is not that help will be given when the pinch comes. Now, unfortunately, they opened their mouths. They were doing so well. They were giving him comfort by sitting with him and crying with him and weeping with him and holding him. And then they decide to open their mouths and give him all this wonderful grand advice, which really does nothing in his life. Now, how do you and I go from miserable comforters to friendly comforters? The friends who say, this is almost an interruption, but I'm here. Because we have a lot more ways to go and a long road to hoe as friends. I can sit with you now, of course. That's the minimum of what I would do. How do you get to that place? Eliphaz mentions it. He says this. First of all, though, you have to look at Job 6:8, and there's a part where Job does a little reflection, and he says this, "So that I might have a request that God would fulfill my hope, that it would please God to crush me." And he ends by saying, "What is my strength that I should wait? What is my end that I should be patient? Is my strength the strength of stones or my flesh bronze? Have I any help in me when resource is driven from me?" Go back to Job 6 and read that. We didn't have time. Translation, Job saying, "I can't do this on my own." And he states this. He says, "I haven't denied the words of the Holy One. I've been true. I've been following him. I've been going to church. I've been praying." Okay, good. That's a good premise. He also admits that, "I don't have the strength to do this on my own. I need help from outside." And he says, "I have nothing in myself to help me get through the suffering." He says, "Have I any help in me?" You know what he's doing? He's pointing you and me right now to grace tonight. He's admitting his weakness. He's admitting his utter weakness to actually fix himself. And he's looking to something outside of himself for that. And he closes here in Job 6 by saying this, "How long will you look away from me, O God, or leave me alone till I swallow my spit?" Somebody much later echoed that in Psalm 22 when he says, David does, my God, why have you forsaken me? Oh my God, I cry by day, but you not answer." Job says, "I'm crying out, and I get nothing." David later says, "I'm crying out, and I get nothing." It's interesting that Jesus on the cross quotes Psalm 22. And it's interesting that Psalm 22 is a mirror of Job 6. Job suffered, and he cries out, and he hears nothing. David suffered, and he cries out, and he hears nothing. But Jesus on the cross cries out, and he hears the spiritual cosmic nothingness of his own Father. See, I told you, Jesus is here. Eliphaz, remember, go back. Remember the great advice Eliphaz gave? Remember, who was innocent that ever perished? Jesus. Who was the upright that was cut off? Jesus. Eliphaz, in his finger-waggering, advice-giving, miserable comfort, actually points you and me, he points Job to somebody who's going to come much later who truly was innocent and he perished, who truly was upright and he was cut off. Why? So that it'll make you and me understand that we worship a God who doesn't just talk about suffering, but he lived it. We worship a God who says, "I'm your friend, and in a pinch I will come." How do you know? Not because C.S. Lewis writes it, because the cross says it. That in your greatest pinch, in your greatest lowness, when people spit on you, when you're at the low, when you've lost everything, what's your answer? Theology? It won't help you. Try it. Sound doctrine? It won't necessarily help you. You will need the God of the universe to reach down and touch you and say, arise and eat. Eat of my son who gave his life for you. He suffered so that you know when you're in your suffering, it won't destroy you. That's not just good theology. That's good friendship. That's not just good friendship. That's good lordship. This is what God says to you and me in our suffering. And listen here, as I could close, you know what this does? It makes you and me, it should make you and me, sing the line that we're going to sing again that we just sang before, because he lives, I can face tomorrow. Do you know that when you go to somebody in suffering and you say that to them, and you sit with them and say, arise and eat, you know that because he lives, you and I will live tomorrow? You give them hope. Job, you don't give them despair. Job says, kill me now. You don't give them pat answers. Job's wife says, curse God and get rid of it. Don't go to church again. It's a waste of time. Job's friends say, pray more, do more, be more religious. The gospel gives us none of those three answers to comfort people in suffering. The gospel, the good news says, look to the one who died for you so that when others suffer, you may point them to him. That because he lives, they can face tomorrow. Now sit down with them and shut up and cry. Touch them. Hold them. That's what he did for you. He cries out on the cross. He rises and he touches you again. He's the ultimate comforter. And you and me will never be any type of comforter for those who suffer unless we see the one who was first comforting us in our suffering and our sin and our brokenness. You live because he lived. And you can face tomorrow because he lives. Take that and let us be gospel comforters to those who suffer. Go in prayer now. Take a moment and reflect on this.